I also bring greetings from Chris Long, ISI's new president and CEO, who began work on Friday and so was not able to join us this weekend. He sends warm regards to all that he knows here and looks forward to coming in the future and taking a greater role in the Philadelphia Society in the years ahead. My name is Mark Henry. I'm Chief Academic Officer at ISI, and we have a panel today on progressivism and the younger generation. I guess that in Philadelphia Society terms, I count as the younger generation still, or something like that, which is tells us something. So, as Sigmund Freud never said, the great unanswered question is, what do conservatives want? You must confess that it's a genuine question, because the characteristic conservative stance for the past two centuries has been one of opposition. We are more clear and unified about what we oppose than by what we propose. Stephen Holmes, in his self-congratulatory and ultimately fatuous book, The Anatomy of Anti-Liberalism, argued that there is no real theoretical substance to conservatism, because those called conservatives through the years have been trying to conserve too many contradictory things. Sometimes absolute monarchy, sometimes constitutional monarchy, sometimes constitutional republics, sometimes free trade, sometimes protected trade, sometimes corporatist authoritarian regimes. But if conservatives have changed their defensive front, it is perhaps because the left has, these same centuries, constantly changed its mode of attack, sometimes advocating enlightened absolute monarchs, sometimes constitutional republics, sometimes plebiscitary democracies, sometimes parliaments, sometimes executive agencies, and lately advocating the supremacy of constitutional courts and global governance, whatever that is. One might say that a sufficient response to Stephen Holmes is tu quoque. Conservatism has been a matter of opposition. One might even say of standing athwart history yelling, stop. But if this is true, then the nature of the opposition is a matter of the first importance. Just yesterday, it seems, our politics was structured by the divide between liberals and conservatives. Today, thanks in no small part to the conservative success at diabolizing the L word, we are invited to consider our politics structured by the divide between progressives and conservatives. Is it this a distinction that makes any difference? On first look, the answer seems to be no. It makes no difference. After all, those who now embrace the label of modern progressives are those, like Hillary Clinton, who yesterday we called liberal. What is more, if we examine the new conservatism that has emerged in reaction to the new progressivism, namely the Tea Party, we discover the empirical political scientists tell us much the same people who just yesterday were known as the religious right. While particular issues may have changed, the underlying fundament remains the same. On second look, the emergence of progressivism as a foil by which to understand conservatism is a clear improvement in our situation. For those among us who identify conservatism with classical liberalism, the new terminology spares us the irksomeness of explaining the difference between classical and modern liberalism, so confusing to undergraduates for so many decades. Moreover, for those among us who have developed an intellectually powerful account of the spoliation visited upon America's natural rights republic by imported German historicist ideas and political schemes, for those, the new language finally gets it right, and Americans are now in a position to understand the real issues that face us. Of course, with gains, there are also losses. The new intellectual framing of our politics, precisely in removing liberalism from its polarity vis-a-vis conservatism, threatens to throw into eclipse the critique of rights talk that was one of the more promising conservative theoretical advances of the 1990s. But I would like to take a third look and consider the question of the progressive slash conservative framing in light of the larger question, what do conservatives want? It seems to me that it is of the essence of conservatism to feel oneself on the losing side of history. And the reason a conservative might feel this way is because for the past two centuries or more, he has been. To stand athwart history yelling, stop. Built into that capsule statement of National Review's original mission is precisely an understanding of the implacable forces of history that are washing away the human goods valued by people like us. Even to arrest this inexorable process, however briefly, thus constitutes an immense achievement of statesmanship. And to actually turn back the clock and retrieve lost human goods is simply beyond imagining. Is it not the case that this deep structure of the modern age, the age of progress, which, by the way, you know, it is a curiosity, isn't it, that our politics is structured by sort of a historical framing. People are ahead and behind. Right and left is sort of back, is sort of past and future, not, for example, framed in terms of the one, the few, and the many. Another major way of you could have structured politics. So is it not the case that this deep structure of the modern age, this historical structure, explains, among other things, how it was that anti-communism functioned as the central tenet of the American conservative movement in its classical Cold War period? After all, communism's proudest boast was that it possessed a science of history by which it knew that the future belonged to the revolutionary left. Arguments about values such as freedom and the individual were, in the end, pointless before the facts of history's inevitable course. It seems to me that generations of conservative reflection on history's course had well prepared us for greeting with grim recognition Whitaker Chambers' statement that in leaving communism for the West, for liberty, and for God, he was joining history's losing side. Nevertheless, Chambers and we would fight the good fight with a quixotic nobility, knowing that without a miracle, our doom was assured. At least in the coming 1,000 years of darkness, our defeat would be worth a song. In effect, then, communism's science made explicit something only inchoately grasped about the permanent predicament of conservatism in the modern world. What do conservatives want? They want to stop the historical forces, those blind, implacable forces, that threatened to efface things held dear. This is how you conserve things. You stop history, arrest it. More deeply, however, what conservatives really want is to forge or discover or to reach a new historical dispensation in which the historical process is not automatically geared to advancing the values of the left. If we ever did reach such a non-progressive historical dispensation, then conservatism as such would cease to exist. At least it would not be called conservatism, because it would not be temporally arranged. It would be a set of political ideas that we sought out to achieve, and not a set of political ideas that were tied anachronistically to the values of a threatened past. There would be neither conservatism nor progressivism. Now, as it happens, this is a sort of important fact, communism did not triumph. By far the most important historical event of my life is communism's collapse. But have any of us really absorbed the significance of this? The inevitable future, the fact of history, was defeated by quite particular human actions and plans and projects. Implacable historical forces turned out to be really quite placable. What should have been the fruit of this experience was a new historical consciousness, one which brought forward the contingency of history, and one which recognized the efficacy of human individual freedom in the making of history. In other words, a new historical consciousness in which we would all speak of history being made, but never speak in terms of history unfolding or advancing or lurching forward or being held back. History is always made by human free actions. I think there were really only two people that I know of who actually, to some degree, absorbed this lesson from communism's collapse. One was Robert Novak, who in an article that appeared in Reader's Digest, of all places, was entitled, "I Was Wrong About Communism and About God's Providential Role in History." Robert Novak was deeply influenced as a young man by Whitaker Chambers, and he therefore thought the West's doom was inevitable himself, but it turned out not to be, and this prompted a realization that human freedom might actually make history with God's help. Also, Chantal Del Sol, in a book, Icarus Fallen, published by ISI, a profound meditation on the collapse of communism in 89 and what that means for the European soul. Those are the only two references I know where this sort of lesson really got in. But instead, as we know, instead of drawing the history, the lesson that history doesn't have a plan or structure that's inevitable and foredoomed. Instead, as we know, conservatives and others were drawn to the intoxicating arguments of Francis Fukuyama after 1989. What Fukuyama learned from the collapse of communism was not that human beings were free and history was there for ours to make. What he learned instead was that Hegel was right rather than Marx. History remained an impersonal realm of irresistible forces, but the end toward which those forces were driving was not Soviet communism, but rather American democratic capitalism. We ourselves were the first to reach history's inevitable and predestined endpoint. Many controversial policy decisions followed from the intellectual inebriation wrought about by the end of history thinking. Now, what does all this have to do with progressivism? You may ask. Just this. While there are ambiguities and tensions within progressivist thought, one unmistakable dimension, it seems to me, of progressivism is its sense that history is not working out the way it's supposed to. In other words, far from it being the case that left to itself, impersonal historical forces are moving us inevitably in a left liberal direction, the progressive thinks, rather, progressivism seems to be a response to an awareness that the opposite is true. History is supposed to be moving irresistibly in the direction of ever more equal liberty and ever freer equality. Today's progressivism proclaims itself as a response, what? To 40 years of stagnant median income levels and burgeoning inequality. Left to itself, the natural forces of the market and of globalization are leading us to greater and greater inequality. The opposite of the way history is supposed to be going is happening, and that is why the progressives need to utilize the main force of the state in all of its majesty in order to try to bludgeon history to do the right thing. And it seems to me also, by the way, that this was true of progressivism in its original form. Progressivism follows on from the Gilded Age. The Gilded Age was a time, it seems to me, unforetold by Tocqueville, when in fact a new aristocracy was emerging that looked pretty darn well like an aristocracy, that was doing sort of aristocratic things. And that wasn't supposed to be able to happen. And so progressivism invokes the power of the state to try to correct history's errants. But of course, if history isn't going in the right direction, then the historical narrative of inevitability is in play again. So, might our new progressivism provide, paradoxically, precisely the privileged occasion for conservatives to shatter the frame of the inevitable leftward progress of history, a frame which is so debilitating and which has kept conservatives as essentially the minority position in the modern age? It seems to me that this is actually an effort, an intellectual effort, that's well worthy of a younger generation. So those are my thoughts on the matter. And we have five other people to share with us their thoughts on progressivism and the younger generation. They are Tiffany Jones Miller, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Dallas. Her PhD is from UCal Davis on campaign finance reform, and she publishes widely on progressivism and on U.S. political institutions. Next to Tiffany is Carrie Roberts, an associate professor of history at Arkansas Tech. His PhD is from the University of South Carolina on Jeffersonianism and, on Jeffersonian thought at the end of the 18th century. And he has lectured and published frequently on Southern history. Next down, we have Scott Segrist, teaching at the United States Military Academy at West Point. His PhD was on the Scottish Common Sense School in America. Next, David Alvis, assistant professor of government at Wofford College, with a PhD from Fordham University on Herbert Crowley. He's also taught at Oglethorpe University and the University of Western Florida. And he is, as you know, I imagine many of you, the son of John Alvis, also of the Philadelphia Society. Last on the panel, Joseph Postel, assistant professor of political science at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs. He has a PhD from the University of Dallas, and he writes widely on political economy, constitutional questions, and the administrative state. Each of our panelists will come up to the podium in turn, have about a 15-minute talk, and then at the end we'll have questions for the whole panel.